The smell of napalm in the morning. Smell! You know that gasoline smell? Smells like victory.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al. Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 61. NASDAQ futures up 253. We're off to a good start this Monday. If you haven't seen that already, we are allegedly Trump walked back on some tariffs. Not sure we're going to start doing that again. Tariffs are in. We're down, tariffs are out, we're up, but evidently that's our current plan. Not sure why that is, but that's what we're doing. So, as of this moment anyway, so that's where we are. Do we have Mr. Moriarty?
Hi, Tom.
How are you, bud?
Doing all right, how about you?
Doing all right. Want to talk some NCAA, maybe talk a little bit of infrastructure. Yeah, I'll get a question out of the way. Because Greg and I have been talking about this, without flying into politics and so forth, when something like a road or a water treatment plant or something does get approved by somebody, you know, I mean, I guess some of that stuff has to go through the state, has to go through the, I know it's a super long procedure for stuff like that to happen. We have.
Were you answering your call?
No, we have an issue with the door downstairs, so Greg has to go down and get Matt.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, that has to happen. But anyway, when all that has to happen, and all of a sudden the project is starting, has you ever heard of one where somebody says, we're not doing it? You just pull the whole thing off? I mean, it seems like I've been trying to find out, and I know you're not an attorney, nor did you ever want to be. I'm trying to figure out whether... when something is approved and signed and moving along, unless there's out-and-out fraud where somebody's like, you know, paying somebody's mother-in-law or something, which I'm sure does happen, that way you cut that piece out, does somebody have the right to stop the damn thing? I just without going back to without going through the same procedure? I guess my question is, has you ever seen that happen?
No, and I don't think it's going to happen. You know, the funding that Biden put out for infrastructure under what's known as IIJA. I think it's, I forget what the acronym stands for, but the last two Jobs Acts, Investment Infrastructure Job Act, I think November of 2022. That was a 5-year funding program. And all of that money is then funneled through the states. And the states do the job of dispensing it and getting these projects started. So if you were the city of Chicago and you were tapping that funding, and of course I would recommend to anybody who needed water or sewer or any of these things to go get that money, because it's either you're going to get a subsidized loan or an outright grant. It's going to save your ratepayers a lot of money. But typically you'd enter into some form of contract with the state agency and the money would be solid. I mean, there's people, I've heard people talking about these disaster scenarios where, you know, try to pull the funding and stuff and people would have things half constructed. I just think the uproar would be so bad, you know, to sit there with a half complete sewer plant not operating and, you know, we're waiting for the money that we thought we had and everything. So that funding has done a lot of good from what I have seen over the last couple of years. And so I think that one plays out.
Well, because the big, one of the fears here in Chicago, I mean, Chicago's not doing so hot in a lot of ways, but some of the ways is that, you know, a lot of people aren't getting fed. And we need to get them back on at a time. Maybe it'll be a job for Greg because he's good at stuff like that. We had the head of the food depository on a few years ago in Chicago. And, you know, there's various, even though there's some programs to help these guys, they are pretty much a charitable organization. I mean, not pretty much, they are. And they feed upwards of 200,000 people a day or some incredible number. And there's a program evidently from the federal side that gives them a some kind of deal where they can get local produce. I mean, most of the stuff is donated, but there's a thing about local produce. And now, for whatever reason, that thing, as of this weekend, is just evidently, from what the TV or radio has been saying, has been just flat-ass cut.
Yeah, that's just tragedy.
And now, whether that's really true or not, or whether, you know, somebody's just saying it, but I'm wondering, that appears to have been, to me, there for a long time. Matter of fact, there was an extended spending bill last week. I would think that Trump signed the damn thing. That's part of the extended spending bill, and all of a sudden this week they're saying, "Oh no, we're cutting that one." I don't know how you. I guess I'm not sure how that happens. I just wonder if it ever happened to any construction job you were ever, you know.
No, our deals would be long-term contracts in place between the state and the community. So if they're properly administered, and I'd say 95% of them would be, they would have this thing tied down so it couldn't be pulled.
It seems like our Doge guys are in kind of a new world. They sort of don't recognize some of this. And I wonder, you know, how they get. I mean, what happened if it did? Somebody go to court and do all the other stuff or whatever? I mean, I don't know what you do.
Yeah, that is a whole different world to me, and you know, it just seems so sudden and disorganized and you know, going to be unnecessarily harmful. I mean, I think everybody is okay with eliminating you know, overstaffing and fraud, waste, abuse, certainly. But what kind of throws me, if there's so much fraud, why aren't we seeing people in handcuffs? I mean, let's start arresting people if there's really fraud, or is it just stuff we're saying, you know? That's what's kind of disturbing.
Well, it seems to me we're mixing up programs we don't really like with fraud. That there's kind of a blend there, and it's kind of an odd blend. You're right. Waste means, I guess, you have three or four people when you could have two or three or something, and every firm has a little bit of that, I guess. But that's, fraud is just plain paying somebody who doesn't do anything at the place at all or something. That to me would be fraud. I mean,
or steal some money somewhere.
Yeah. And, you know, it seems like there's a lot of, I know that there's a lot of like subcontracting. Well, there's subcontracting and certainly money management for portfolios of the police and fire and you name it. And I would certainly say that it's set up not like I would set it up. I mean, to me, there's a lot of waste in there with the different levels of people getting paid. And, you know, I wouldn't exactly call it fraud. I would do it a lot differently. That would be cheaper. But I don't think anybody would go to jail for it. I wouldn't call it waste. It just seems like there's a lot of people with their fingers in the pie. I have to believe that when you guys do a treatment plant, some of it is subcontractors. If he goes out for a proper bid, I don't think there's any waste or fraud there. Now, if there's not a proper bid, well, that might be a horse of a different color. I mean, I don't know how you determine this in like 3 days in a place.
In my years as working as an engineer and coming from Chicago, one of the things we used to be very, and I think people still are, I'm not saying, is we were always conscious of what's known as bid rigging. And that's a situation where when you have a competitive bid, let's say someone is able to discourage other bidders to the point there's only one or two. And if you ever see one bidder, that's a red light. You immediately throw the bid out and start over. But over the years, and that's really the best way to do things. If you can get seven or eight construction companies or whatever type of service you're procuring to competitively bid with a well-prepared set of specifications and plans, you're going to get the best value. But I'll say one thing about my industry. They have, over the last 20 years, have done a lot to get away from that, what I think is a real pure model for price competition. And they've got all kinds of these design build schemes, and I'm saying schemes in more of a European way. I'm not accusing them necessarily of doing bad things, but it really takes the competitive edge out of things. And I think part of it is municipal governments are not able to hire the kind of people they really need to run these things. Because when you get into a competitively bid project, if something goes wacky with the plans, you might have a lawsuit. And that happens. And you've got to be ready to participate in some kind of dispute. Whereas these less competitive things, you sort of are able to smooth over those problems easier, but it's way more expensive. And no one can convince me. I mean, I think you're adding 20% to these jobs that's just going to nothing with these other non-competitive type approaches. So I'd be real suspicious about that. But hopefully we can stay with the regular bidding. That's the way to do it.
Well, I noticed that one of my buddies, and you know him, the guy who, there was a time kind of, when I first started down here, they a lot of buildings were being built downtown. Well, now obviously they're not. Like Fort 40, LaSalle, and they're all kind of the same sort of, 35 to 40 floors. They weren't any of the 100-story floors like we did, you know, when we were younger, when you built the Sears Tower and those kinds of places. And these are all kind of, without getting into the detail that Bill knows and I don't, but your Sears Tower, your First National Bank building, those kinds of places are all basically, they're huge and they're anchored into like the bedrock, right? You clean out the entire site and you're down to the bedrock and you do all that. Well, these other ones, you don't do that anymore. You dig down some, and then there's all these drills, and it's all caissons, right? And they're probably not as well constructed, but I don't know that they're going to fall down or anything like that. There's a group that did virtually all the caisson work, right? And if people went to get another bid, he'd say, "Okay, I'll get another bid." Well, he owned like all three companies. Typical Chicago. How many people are capable of doing something like that? I mean, where you actually go out and get legitimate bid, unless you go somebody from out of state and all those other kinds of places. I'm leading this to a direction more toward Florida, but then what if there aren't any other bidders? I mean, how many people in this area, other than Walsh and a couple others, are capable of redoing the expressway? I mean, you reach the point where there's really only a couple of guys that can do it, right?
Yeah, that definitely becomes a limitation of, these massive projects that there is only so much capability in the marketplace, and you are, and you're probably going to get hurt by that, because I don't think you're getting true competition if you only got, a couple guys, the same two or three bidding all the time. They're going to be making some money on you. I mean, one thing that you can do is to try to get away from the massive projects, because a lot of people can't bid projects because they can't get bonded for the amount of money in the job. So if you make the job...
Explain that to what everybody... Pullman used to do that. They'd have to give you'd have to post a bond. But Pullman had never reneged on a contract in 1860, you know, so I don't think the bank even you know, the bank just signed it pretty much.
A contractor has to produce a performance bond for the amount of the job, and you know, when you get the job way up, that bond, it becomes to the point where not many people can get that bond, you know, and that's guaranteeing the performance of the contractor. If he goes bankrupt on the job, the bonding company will step in and finish the job. And I've had a couple of those deals where we've lost the contractor because of bankruptcy or failure, whatever you want to call it. And then you bring in another contractor, and it is an absolute mess, because you're sitting there with this half-finished project and nothing can, you know, the old guy is gone, the gates are locked, and you sit there and you have this scrum, sometimes even in the courthouse, to get project moved over to a new guy, and a new contractor comes in working for the bonding company, and he's basically on a deal where he's just getting paid by the hour, so he's not worried about anything. This is a good job for him, and he finishes the job, and it just takes a lot longer. It's a big mess and stuff. So contractor failure, that's a whole world of a place that you don't want to visit, because it's trouble.
What maybe last question in this area, because I want to get to basketball. Are most of these jobs, do the contractors have to finance it, or is there enough? I ask this question because when Pullman did the Massachusetts Bay Railroad car contract that I did, I believe Amtrak was somewhat the same way. It was designed so you didn't have to, you, Pullman, did not have to essentially, you know, once you were, you know, got the bond and that stuff, you didn't have to front up any money, really. I mean, you got 10% when the contract was signed. You got like 10% when the undercar arrangement drawing was approved. You got, I don't know, when the first car was laid down, you got another 20. So if you did it right, the only thing left at the end was essentially your profit of 10%. So you, because Pullman lost money on it, of course they had to dig in their own pocket. But if it went according to plan, and went according to the bid, and you didn't lose, though, you never were in your own scratch, which is a whole different brand of ball than if at the end you're getting one check for $65 million and you had to finance it the whole way. Most of these, you know, water plants and things like that you were involved in, or even highways, is the construction person company, are they ever in their own cash? Or it would seem like if they're in their own cash, you're limiting it to one or two people. I mean, who the hell can finance something like that on their own?
They're all into their own cash a little, because you're going to be subjected generally to monthly draws. So the first month of operation on the job, you're gonna be spending your own money. And then on day 30, you're going to provide an invoice, progress payment, if you will. And of course, it'll take the city probably 45 days to pay that. So then you'll be replenished for the first month's work, and then that you'll get that cycle. When you get to the end, they'll hold what's known as retainage, which you won't get that released until the job is accepted. And typically acceptance on a job means not just the construction works, but all the machinery works, and it's all checked out and it's all approved. And if there's a pump over there that didn't break, well, that's your problem to go get the new pump and get it replaced. And, you know, there's a whole chain of kind of responsibility in those things. And then only when everything is done, you get your final check. And owners are pretty careful. They don't release that final check until they're really convinced that things are okay.
But you didn't get a 10% of the deal like as soon as it's signed, so the money was theirs from start.
That's not it. I've never seen that in my world, where we start fronting money to people. I think the traditional city type buyer in this world would say, I don't want to fool with somebody who doesn't have that financial wherewithal. If you're coming to play in my game, you better have the ability to carry a couple months of this work, and we'll pay you promptly. Now, contractor, and they typically do have expert guys at getting these pay estimates put together and running them over and getting them approved, and you know they'll be super pushy about that, which they need to be, but that's how it's typically played.
Yeah, in this world, we've talked from time to time. I know you listen in as to how the difference in size of companies now. I mean, I've never seen a spread like this in terms of what a favored place can get money for versus somebody who's maybe a regular place. You know, I don't know. You would think that if the firm is fronting, well, if you're talking 30 days plus 45, and you've got 300 people working on the job, well, that's one hell of a lot of dough. The difference, I mean, if somebody who can do a bridge or something, all of a sudden they take on an expressway, do they have the financing, or do they have the relationship with several banks where they can draw that down at 5-7%, or are they paying 15% where somebody else is paying 5%? I mean, you essentially are driving people out of the bidding process if the financing becomes too big of a part of the billing process. Kind of where I'm going with this.
Yeah, those contractors would all have banking relationships to carry the job, so to speak. So the better contractors, the more successful contractors, have better relationships and get better deals on that interim kind of financing.
I guess the question I'm dying to ask is, once you get below Walsh here in Chicago, who the hell can bid if you're expecting them to come up with the dough?
Well, and of course, what always happens is if there's not enough people locally, then you go a countrywide, worldwide. And there's plenty of big contractors in the world. But I'll tell you right now, and again, from my perch, not exactly in the middle of the city of Chicago, but there's a ton of work out there right now. Every contractor that I talk to are at their limits for what they can bid. Again, back to the bonding issue. You know, they'll say, hey, are you going to bid anything this month? And I can't get bonded for it. You know, I'm bonded up, as they say. So, because there's so much work on the street, I mean, you kind of take all these factors, not the least of which is the federal government pushed a lot of money out, and all that money started to move in November of 2022. So all of that money has been grinding through the engineering people drawing plans. Well, all of those jobs are flowing out onto the street to be bid, and more and more. And the problem is, of course, is that what happens is the prices go up. So you have the competition becomes limited as through the process I just described, and everybody's going to there're just going to be fewer bidders, and people are going to not bid real tough like they might have back in the 80s or something. So that's the things are going to get more expensive.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the thing that is somewhat obvious in this Chicago area, drive around too much, I guess, is the jobs are almost being, it seems like they're being inventoried, that there's nobody working on anything, and yet they're all the bridge out, when I go out to the southwest burbs, they replace half the bridge on LaGrange Road over the Des Plaines River Valley. You know what I'm talking about. And,
right.
Bill, it was a five-year plan. I mean, some of it was COVID, but I don't know how you work construction from home necessarily. I'd go by there and there'd be five guys there. And the next day, there'd be two, and then you wouldn't see them, then there'd be 10. And once in a while, they'd do a piece, and there'd be a bunch of people there. And I'm sitting there going, don't they ever want to finish this thing? And then even little stuff like the Franklin Bridge, it took them all last summer to replace the sidewalks. The guy was never... I go by there in the morning, he wasn't there. I go by there in the afternoon at 4:30, he's not there. They're working 8 hours, they got five guys. I mean, it was like they never wanted to finish it. Well, if you're bonded out, you would think you'd want to knock some of these off, wouldn't you?
You would. Yeah, that's not a good thing when you see projects that are semi-abandoned like that. I mean, if it were mine, I'd have a meeting with somebody and say, we got to get this thing finished because I got other things to work on too, you know. So
what do you think? What do you think of the Hoops? I thought the I don't know if you watched any of the girls, but I thought that a lot of these teams were becoming a little more parity. But boy, it sure seems like the better teams really spanked the lower teams, you know, in the 8 and 9s and so forth. I guess it's being a little more parity in the women's basketball, but still, it seems like the good teams really trounce the teams just under. I mean, you've seen a little of that in the men's, but you know, not that much. You know, some of the teams, there's been a couple of upsets, but there's also been some pretty good games. It seems like the upsets in the first round, like the McNeese States of the world, they never can make it through the second game. I don't know if they're still cheering or whether they're tired or it only happens once or what, but it seems like it's hard to go through the second. What's the nature of the Greg said something about there's a protest on the Wisconsin game. What's that all about? Do you have any idea?
I don't know about that one. I watched part of that, but I don't know the details of that. And but I would say this about the tournament so far. It's been pretty much chalk where all of your number one seeds have survived. Three of your number twos have survived. Two of your threes have survived, and three of your fours have survived. So the highest seed that's still alive is a 10th seed in the form of Arkansas.
Wow.
So generally, this thing has gone, you know, by the ratings kind of thing. The other disappointing thing in terms of Chicago area schools, which if you leave out the state of Michigan, and I'm not necessarily advocating for that, you had Marquette and Illinois, and of course Marquette went down Friday. And Illinois went down yesterday against Kentucky. So it was, it seems like the game of basketball has sort of moved into the South.
Yeah.
Where the Southeastern Conference have really, you know, they've got 7 schools that are still in the tournament out of 16 remaining.
Well, they had 14 total in.
They had 14 bids, yeah. So they lost
seven.
Half of
seven. They lost half. Yeah.
The other observation I would make is that the Patinos, father and son, who both won a game, but they're both out now. They both lost their second round game, so the Patinos are gone. And then the coach of local interest here in Austin, Texas, Rodney Terry of the University of Texas, was fired right after his play-in game loss.
Oh, really? I didn't notice that.
And they're going to hire the coach from Xavier, the team that beat him in the play-in game. That coach will take the UT job.
And what's his salary going to be? I think the Notre Dame job is what, almost $3 million. Some of these guys, I mean, it's.
Oh, yeah, they'll pay him. You know, the University of Texas basketball program had been a real stable job for many years. The guy who's now coaching Tennessee, he was here in Austin for 15 years, and you know he did okay, and they finally got tired of him. And then they had Shaka Smart here for a number of years. And, of course, Shaka is now the coach at Marquette. And then after him, they got a guy named Chris Beard, who's now the coach at Ole Miss. And the one mistake Chris Beard made was one night after maybe having a couple of cocktails, he decided to choke his girlfriend.
Not to death, I hope.
Not to death. But as a matter of fact, choked her to the point she called 911, and she gave a pretty good statement to the police that this guy choked me. So here he was, the head coach of the University of Texas. He was thrown in jail and locked up for a couple nights. And he hired what I would say was one of your better criminal lawyers in the Austin area. And University of Texas fired him the next day, so he lost his job. But it took him about a year and a half, and he's back with Mississippi. He's got one of the 16 surviving teams. He's considered a really good coach. He's just not maybe a great guy to go drinking with after hours. So Sean Miller of Xavier will come to Austin to run the program starting probably today. I mean, he's probably already here, you know.
It's they expect these guys to win. They sort of wink. You're almost hiring the guy that can get around. What was the nature of Calipari's departure from Kentucky over to Arkansas?
You know, he hadn't won anything in a while, and I mean, that place is they're going to have super high expectations. They probably consider anything less than a Final Four a complete failure. So. They ran him out, but Arkansas immediately picked him up. And I'll tell you, Arkansas, as I mentioned, is the highest seeds. And I watched that game with St. John's, and I was pretty familiar with St. John's being a Marquette fan. And Marquette played St. John's three times this year and lost every time. And they looked like a real good team. And Arkansas handled them very well. And he looks like he's got some athletes. But one of the things with a guy like Calipari, when he comes to a program, he's just not taking the job for the salary. You've got to explain to him how he's going to get NIL money, and I mean lots of it.
Yeah.
He's not going to take that job if he can't attract. And he's got such a network. He knows where all the players are, and he knows what they want to get paid. So he walks into the table and says, well, we need so much NIL money so that we can put together a team. If they don't give it to him, he won't take the job.
I don't know if you watched. I just happened to be watching the Auburn game. It was a couple months ago. And one of the guys on Auburn, the big star, I forget his name, he had been injured, and, you know, was he coming back, and was he 100%, all that kind of crap. So the dude makes it back, and it was like his first or second game, and the guy is a stud. I mean, one of the ladies doing the human interest story goes through his routine for the day, you know, getting up at, like, you know, the god-awful hour of, like, 8 o'clock, you know, and going to rehab and then doing something else and going to weight room and then going to, you know, watching films for 2 hours and actually attending practice and doing what he can and having dinner and then some other shoot-around or something, and, you know, finally not getting back to his dorm to, like, whatever. Well, she totally forgot the word class anywhere in there. Right, and I just wonder, has it reached that point with these guys that we're not even making a whiff at school? I mean, I think you still have some kind of rules regarding progress toward education or something, which I don't see how that applies at all to the graduate guys. I mean, who cares whether they make any progress or not? I mean, is anybody? I don't even think the NCAA has a program to figure out whether they're actually going to class. Maybe they do. I mean, are we reached the point where why even bother? We're just having these. I mean. I don't even know.
No, I think some of the kids that I think are can see a little further down the road that basketball is not going to be there forever are doing some good work in school. I would not be surprised that there are some student athletes that don't ever go to school and they actually have an arrangement with a tutor to do whatever limited schoolwork they need to get done in terms of turning in papers or stuff, and that their life is just roaming around playing basketball. So, because I mean, if you're thinking that after a year of this college or two of this college stuff, I'm going to be in the pros anyways, it's probably you know, not an important thing.
Well, didn't
you
think the
make generational money doing that? Then, yeah, what do I need to worry about college?
Well, didn't the what's the group down, whatever the league is, where the last couple of years, you know, half of the top. Say half of the top 20 picks in the NBA have been from this area. These guys, and not from a school. The league in Florida, whatever the hell do they call it, where you essentially don't have to masquerade as a college student for 2 years to learn how to play basketball and join the NBA.
Right, I know what you're talking about.
Is the NIL money must be better than that? I would guess.
I would say so. I mean, I think if you're a top guy. NIL money, college player, you could be making a couple million bucks in basketball.
Well, what's the difference? I mean, we've identified, you know, we're going to get John in here pretty soon. But we've identified on the show, I mean, me and the other guys, there's got to be like four or five at least different types of NIL money. I mean, if you look at what the, I mean, I'm somewhat familiar through Kevin, what some of the young ladies are getting at Notre Dame, okay? And their NIL money is pretty much, I'm sure the school's getting them something. I mean, they're not playing for free. I'm not that naive. But I don't know what that comprises. It's probably not all that much. It's a few local people and, you know, the pizza joints and whatever. I mean, there might be more than that. But like Hannah Hidalgo has got her own shtick, and a couple of the other ladies are on commercials as well. She got her own shtick with Red Bull. And she's, you know, on the commercials. And by the way, she's cute as a button. She's very articulate. I mean, she's somebody you want on your commercial. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the lady from Iowa. What the hell's her name? Caitlin Clark. She does a nice job on the commercials. She does a nice job on Saturday Night Live. I mean, she's not just a basketball player, and she's a credit to your company. The one, it was the African-American girl who was on the new State Farm commercial or whatever it was. She does a great job. I mean, she's pretty. She talks fine. I mean, when I say that, I'm not trying to degrade it. I'm saying you can put somebody. Some of these guys that are making this dough, you don't want them anywhere near your company, do you? I mean,
I think the person that's making the most NIL money in college sports is Manning's nephew here at the University of Texas.
The Bears quarterback was making a chunk for a long while, but now he's not doing it anymore. Now he had a website. Does the Manning kid have a website?
I don't know that I follow it that carefully, but I'm told he's making something like $8 million a year. And he hasn't played very much. You know, his first 2 years, he was kind of a backup. I mean, I think he was brilliant doing that, you know. Why run out there and get your neck broken? He was still making quite a bit of money, and he'll start playing this year, see how good he is. But what he's shown in flashes has been pretty good. But they say those top-notch quarterbacks are, you're talking $5, $6 million to get them.
But didn't he, I could be hallucinating here, wasn't he on a commercial with his two uncles?
Could have been. Yeah, I mean, that would make all the sense in the world. Tap into there.
Yeah, and I mean, so that money's essentially all his or his family. I mean, Texas didn't do that for him, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen, and you know, Austin is a way smaller market than Chicago, but you know, we'll see him on billboards, you know, wearing their jersey and holding up something, and around here. You know, you could make the top flight, because we don't have any professional sports. There is nothing. The best thing, the big sports thing here is University of Texas.
You're sort of like Lincoln, Nebraska in that regard.
Yeah, it's just like that.
Now, do you and a lot of your neighbors, for lack of a better term, do you like go to the baseball games and the other sports? Like, I mean, there's people in Notre Dame that. It's South Bend that have had baseball season tickets for years.
Have lots of friends that have baseball. And again, at University of Texas, you're going to see a pretty decent brand of college baseball.
Well, they're always top 20, aren't they?
Oh, sure. And they've won in the last 20 years. I think they've won the national championship one time. And, you know, they always produce two or three major leaguers, I'd say, every year that come out of Texas. I think it's a good program, and if the coach doesn't win in that game too, they fire him right away. You know, there's no waiting for anything. But yeah, around here, that's all you have are non-professional sports.
Well, I'm starting to see a split.
Pro sports, you can go to Dallas or Houston or San Antonio.
We'll keep this for next time you're on. But I'm fascinated, and we have a lot of guys that are writing in and, you know, helping me out with this. If you're whatever you are. It's not like you go out and recruit your five guys, then you just become a basketball coach, you know, like the era of Digger Phelps. Or those guys, you know, you're talking about now it's, you're constantly, I'm curious, I'd love to interview, you know, somebody big, for lack of a better term, and say, okay, how many people at Notre Dame or Illinois or Marquette is, I think that's, what's his name's, maybe his biggest, I'll use the term problem, though, is he's kind of late to embrace this everything through the portal routine. The Marquette guy, but it's,
you know, Shaka is not a portal guy.
That's what I'm saying.
He's a recruit him out of high school guy and develop him. And a lot of people are criticizing him. They haven't in the past, but this year they're saying, if you could have plugged in a couple of bigger guys, center, specialty shooter, it would have been smart. And I don't think he would have any money, any problem getting that money, but he seems to be philosophically opposed to doing that. Whereas like Calipari, or like take Pitino, when Pitino took over St. John's, he had a team last year. He cut the entire team.
Yeah,
and brought
yeah.
the whole big team, with the exception of one or two guys. So, and again, he travels with an NIL backer, a guy that's going to write big checks or put these guys on the payroll. So he's probably at his level has a relatively unlimited pocketbook for that sort of thing.
He knows nothing. You know nothing about that, right, Sergeant?
Oh, it used to be they knew nothing, and now they're like, well, this is normalcy. So we're.
I just wonder. Matter of fact, we'll let you go here, but it's food for next time on. Maybe with Kevin, because you guys know more about this than me. Instead of me trying to argue with him, if you and I were on the board of Marquette or Notre Dame or someplace. I wonder, just on a cost basis, because you know my brain is locked into money all the time. I wonder, on a cost basis, what it costs now to actually recruit somebody. Because I mean, none of these guys are going to put their sorry ass in a Southwest jet, right? It's going to be a private jet to go look at somebody and visit their home and all this other kind of crap. And of course, if you're bringing them to Marquette, I'm sure they're in a private jet, right? I mean, I'm not sure, but if you look at the cost of recruiting people, and you're gonna lose people through the portal. So I don't know as much as, you know. Remember a Broadwalk Empire where it says you can't be half a gangster, Nucky? I wonder if you can be that chaste where you're just going to use the old method. Because what if you recruit five guys and somebody steals three of them? How do you replace them? I mean, I don't know how you can be.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you get a star, you got to be able to retain them.
I mean, I'm not just paying for them, but I'm saying what if he's sitting there and two or three of his teammates leave and goes, like, nobody left. You know, I mean, I don't know how you can be out of the pool. And yet, also, I don't see how many people do you have to hire. What did Kevin say one time? It was like, in football, there were 2,500 people or something in the portal. The school's not going to send you practice films to help you get their guy out of there. I mean, how do you even know, unless you recruited him and know all about him, which is, you know, it happens a lot, I think. How the hell do you ever find anybody? How do you even know if the guy's gotten bigger, stronger, is he playing well in practice, or you never saw him at all? And of course, the guy wants money. How much do you know to bid the guy? I mean, I got to believe that's becoming a more intensive process than the coaching itself.
Well, if you notice, when Belichick took the job at North Carolina, he brought in a guy who worked with him at the Patriots. And he calls the guy the general manager. And I kind of, my ears perked up when I heard that, because most colleges don't have a general
manager. Oh, you know what? They're going that way.
Yeah, they're all thinking, you know, how do we organize the acquisition of talent? And they're doing it completely different than the old, you know, going to the camps and watching people throw. Well, now they're just, you know, finding the best guys, and what do you want to get paid?
Can you imagine, like, Ray Meyer and Digger Phelps and those guys managing a portal? They wouldn't know what the
hell. That would be funny to think about. Yeah, that would be something.
Do we have Mr. Flanagan? We do?
Indeed.
How about, unless you have any questions for Bill before we let him go? Because if I keep him on too long, then he won't come back.
Well, morning, Bill.
Hi, John.
I enjoyed what you were saying about, you know, construction projects, you know, being interminable now. And do you think there was a tipping point when construction companies or bureaucracies realized there was more money to be made by not finishing projects, or at least finishing them on time, than, you know, ramping it up and getting them done quickly? Because it seems to be an epidemic now of stuff taking forever.
I would hesitate to think that that's a premeditated activity, that we're going to kind of play along with the job and that's some way going to make me money. The reputable construction companies I've worked with over the years, I've worked at some really big ones, that was never their philosophy. They wanted to get things done and move on to the next job and get their profit out of the job. So if what you're all seeing, and it's I see it too around here, I think there's that's indicative. I think if there's lots of work, so it's very hard to keep talent. And in the construction industry, talent are those engineers or those construction workers, those kind of people. It's hard to keep those guys that know what they're doing. So everybody's suffering probably from a weak bench, and they just can't move things along. But I hope it's not what you think. So anyways.
Yeah, I don't really want to go there. I know the city used to be notorious, and they still are, I think, for unnecessary projects like putting asphalt down in every alley, whether it was needed or not, and creating other problems in the process, and ripping it up again after a couple of years, and doing the same thing with street repairs. So it's like built-in obsolescence. You don't want a project that is done so well that it doesn't have to be done again in 18 months. Just keep the ball rolling. But there seems to be something else at work now, because it's just these are massive projects, and they take a lot out of the economy when they're not finished on time or correctly or safely.
And yeah, I don't think owners, when I say owners, that could be the highway department, the cities, they do a very good job of understanding the costs to the public. When, as I hear guys like you and Tom talk about this, where the expressway's ripped up for 10 years and, millions of people are occupied, stuck in their car, what's the value of that? I don't think anybody thinks about that stuff. But my general impression is, if you have good people planning and executing the job, they won't have that. And they'll anticipate that, and they won't let it happen. But I think some people, quite honestly, don't know what they're doing. So.
Well, the Kennedy fiasco now, which has been a fiasco for 3 years, it's a new low this year. I don't know if you know. I mean, you used to live here. The Kennedy going north, there's the express lanes, right? And they'd reverse those. For the inbound is heavy, they're heavy coming in, and blah blah blah. Well, this is the year they did the inbound lanes, the inbound 4 2 years ago. Last year they did the express lanes. And of course, it was supposed to be over November 3rd or something. It didn't finish till January. They screwed that up. So immediately, they give the same project to the same people, like this year's starting. Well, now, you would think, well, what's the problem? There's going to be, the express lanes are going to be going outbound all the time. That's two lanes. And we're going to cut off two of the local lanes. And so you're at four, and it's not going to be great. But, by the way, it's not horrible either. Well, the bleep show is, they're doing the two inside lanes of the locals going out, which means the only two lanes available are the two outside. Well, the express lanes pile into those lanes at the far end, so you can go either to the Edens or to the Kennedy, which means going to the airport. Well, now if you're on the express lanes, you can only go on the Edens, which means that the two lanes, you think you have four, but you really only have two. So it started last week. This weekend, you could not go anywhere on the Kennedy. You couldn't put another car on there. The express lanes, you're flying along, but nobody can use them because everyone wants to go to the airport or that way. So my brother and I, we made a sales call, essentially, Saturday morning early, new client, out in Barrington. So we leave at 7, so we're okay. But I noticed they're already starting the project, like, pretty darn fast. But they're starting by downtown. The first two bridges they're working on are the ones downtown. You would think that you would want to get those between where the slip ramp is on this express to the outside mile and a half is the ones you want to finish first, because that's where your problem is. They're starting from this end. Now, who makes that? I mean, maybe they're doing it today or something. Who makes that stupid call, Bill? I mean, who? Even I'm going along there, and I'm going, why aren't we, our problem is at the ass end of this thing, why are we starting on the other end?
Yeah, that's all at the planning stages of the project, how you're going to sequence it, and you got to think through these things very carefully, especially with these high-capacity highways, it's a super complex thing, but sometimes too, and I'll say this maybe in defense of the people doing it, because sometimes you just end up with a selection of nothing but bad choices. There's just nothing you can do. It's going to be either be bad this way or it's going to be real bad the other way, so you end up with bad because you're stuck with so many cars. You know, when you rehabilitate a road and you maintain the traffic on it, it's a tough job, you know, trying to keep lanes going and keep everybody moving. And wouldn't it be great if we could just I've heard people over the years say, why don't we just shut it down for 3 years and work 24/7? Okay, but where'd all those cars
go? Where are you going to go? Well, that's the north side is you know, kind of a bleep storm anyway, traffic-wise. So everybody's like on Elston Avenue, everybody's on Clybourne. So you can't, you can't, even Armitage at night, there's people you can't even drive down Armitage. Because everybody's trying to make the, for those who don't know about Chicago, the south side, where, you know, say not a lot of people want to live these days, actually has a lot of streets that are pretty big. It's the, I'll say, the older part of the city, wouldn't you guys? So the infrastructure, the streets versus houses and stuff, is really a hell of a lot nicer than the north side. There's more parks, there's more everything. North side, the main streets are two lane, and now we've got bike lanes and half of those, Bill. I mean, you haven't seen those, but there's really no place to displace any cars on the north side. I mean, you could have people go down Western Avenue or National Avenue and those things on the south side. There's no way you can do it on the north side. Am I right, John, or what? I mean, that's... Right. That's
oh, yeah. Well, they were built as arterial streets because the traffic came into Chicago pretty much from the south end of town. So streets like Indiana and Michigan were almost like, you know, limited access roads when they were built. And they were designed to accommodate big, you know, four lanes of traffic, really. Nothing like that on the north side.
Well, Bill, if you do have something like the Kennedy Project last year, now they claim it was all software on the gates that opened for the express and let this group go and the other group go. On a project that, November, December, January, it was almost February, on a project that goes 3 months over or 5 years over on the Jane Byrne, do these guys have the political muscle to still make money on that stuff, or do they take a hit, or you don't know?
Don't know. I mean, again, it's how the contract is structured. If it were me running it, there would be a deadline, and they would pay a penalty for every day it was late. And of course, they dispute those penalties, and they'll say, well, you did something wrong. But that's how you got to kind of play the game to keep these guys, get to keep their attention, is if it's costing them money. But believe me, if they're out there under some kind of arrangement where they're just getting paid by the hour, yeah, you ain't going to get anywhere anytime soon. That's not it's not a good spot to be in.
Well, Bill, how about we let you go, and maybe next Monday we'll do some more on the NCAA's, a lot of good stuff. Are you golfing today, or are you guys too cold?
Country Club is closed on Mondays, so this is a good day to talk to me.
Why can't you scoot out? And isn't that what we used to be able to play with the caddies when it was Monday? Do you guys have caddies?
We don't have caddies, but I think I'm getting to play 6 days a week, so I'm not pushing it.
Oh God, one of my good buddies and one of our biggest clients, his son used to caddy out at Bobolink for Ditka and those guys. Man, the stories I hear from those guys. You know, there wasn't even any. According to him, there wasn't even really like a. Well, maybe there was. But, there wasn't a 9-hole rate or an 18-hole rate like you and I did. You know, you just, and these guys, all they did was gamble, and they only wanted certain guys, you know, so they could, like, kick the ball off behind a tree and stuff. But he goes, these guys were, Ditka's group, there'd be maybe four guys. They'd all have their own carts. Right, so they're flying down the fairway, and two guys would still be putting, so you're holding the pin. The other two guys go to the next tee and already tee off, and if they lose their ball, they're bitching at you. Can you imagine? Can you imagine playing for guys like that? I guess the money was worth it, but man, oh man. he goes, caddying is so stressful here, it's worse than having like a real high-tech job. He's caddying.
Well, the next time I'm on your show, remind me to tell you the story of the time I caddied for Forrest Tucker. And you remember him, right,
Tom?
Oh, yeah.
I used to run into him. Remember Dave Ward at Marist?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember at ND.
Yeah, and he went to ND. He I don't know how he got the job, but he was the guy who put the Beverly Country Club, if, you know, there was a graduation one night and a wedding the next day, he was there at 6 putting up the tables and setting the place up for the wedding. I mean, it does just happen by itself, right? And once in a great while, if it was like nobody in there, if there was a dance and then he had to bring in like 100 tables, he'd call me on a Friday night and I'd meet him over there. Well, Forrest Tucker, once in a while, he'd be in the bar drinking still at like 7:30. He's a big guy.
He was a giant guy, and he was doing dinner theater at that place.
At the Martinique. That's where, at the Drury Lane.
Yeah,
that's why he was drinking in the bar. He was at the Drury Lane.
And I, for a period of time, and I have no idea why this was, I was his favorite caddy, or at least that's what he told me. Probably told that to anybody that caddied for him. But I have a very funny story, and the only reason I think it's still funny was a couple years ago, I was at Second City there in Chicago with my sister and other family members, and they were doing whatever you call that comedy where people just yell out a name and stuff. And so they did that. And somebody yelled out golf. And the guy, 50 years after it happened, told my story. And I was in shock. But I won't keep it today.
But he was, you know, but I guess his routine was, you know, the play'd get over at 12 probably or 11:30. They had a theater in the round there. It was way advanced. They always had a star. It'd be Elkie Summer or him or what's his name? The guy from a man, Robert Vaughn, was there for a while. I mean, these guys would come and do the play. He always had a star. And but Forrest Tucker must not have been able to sleep after the thing. And he'd hang in the bar at Beverly till like 10, and then probably go back and sleep till 4 or 5 or whatever. I mean, that was kind of his routine. But he was pounding them down pretty good. And as you know, Bill,
at 7:30 in the morning on the golf course, he was drinking directly out of a flask.
Okay.
I don't mean mixing the flask with something. I mean, he was drinking.
And
the thing about the guy, he was a 4 handicap, and he was a great golfer.
Okay.
And no amount of drinking harmed him. You know, he was able to play just fine.
Those guys were professional drinkers, weren't they? Anyway, Bill, we'll save that for next time. Real quick, SP Futures up 67, NASDAQ Futures up 295. We talked about it last week. John, are we still in the market? Was been down for 4 or 5 weeks. Are we still in the range of one utterance by our POTUS, where he might back off on the? Can we get it all back with that or half back? I think he's got enough of a hole where I don't think we get it all back. But today doesn't surprise me all that much. But I didn't hear the actual story this weekend, or is it just a rumor or cutting back on stuff? Did you happen to see what they were talking about? John, are you there?
Yeah, sorry, Tom.
I was just saying, the rumor is that they might delay some of the tariffs or something, and that's why we're popping up here this morning.
Yeah, I just was reading about that last night. And the whole thing is, you know, it's gamesmanship at some level, where, you know, they're no sooner announced and they're retracted by the end of the day, or they're increased and then cut in half. And I think this was always the plan. So it's hard to keep track of it. It's hard to say who's on first sometimes. But it's very much about, you know, wheeler dealer kind of approach to things.
Well, if you cut through the fog, which is boy hard to do, my view of the last 2 weeks in terms of the market is we don't have any. We've rolled our puts down for our people, which means we're still protected. But now we really like the market to go up. So today is it's not like I predicted it or anything like that. I mean, you've been in as long as I have, John. You know. When you're really right, like today, you know, you're just playing the odds, and hopefully, you know, maybe you're lucky, you know, I mean, no, whatever, because who knows, we could have gone the other way today, we didn't, but we have ourselves all set up for a rally, which is, you know, which is real nice. I mean, that's what you do for people, is you try and keep protected and still make money. In the last week, it was really obvious in Powell's speech. This is actually leg two of the story, that he was basically ready to bleep can the 2% inflation number. It's still their goal, but it might be a goal for the year 2075, right? It's like maybe it's my goal to be 205 pounds again, right? But I'm not going to worry about it today, kind of thing. I don't think 205 is ever going to happen. Because I don't think I'd be playing handball 4 days a week and be in 5 basketball leagues. I doubt that's going to happen. Anyway.
Me either.
I don't think that's going to happen. But I'm saying, I guess it's still a goal. You know, if I were to write 10 of them down. I mean, his goal for being 2% inflation is so far afield of his goal of keeping the market up and asset prices where they are. It's not even close. So that's, to my read, that's what he talked about last Wednesday with all the other crap. But it followed, what, 2 or 3 or 4 days, the essentially everybody in Europe, Germany leading it, saying that they're going to all of a sudden increase their essentially fiscal policy to allow for infrastructure and huge amounts of defense spending, which means they're going to go A, into debt, in which case they're going to borrow all the money, which I doubt, or somehow or another they're going to find a way to print it, like during COVID, oh, maybe not as bad. And then the European Central Bank basically came out and said that they lowered rates, and they basically came out very dovish, maybe 4 or 5 days before the Fed. So anybody who doesn't get the connection there, I think, hasn't been listening to the show or haven't been looking through the world wide open. More money pouring into the system is going to help the market. Now, last time, they were also able to increase the balance sheet and lie on the CPI numbers to where they got away with it. The same, it looks to me like the same formula, John. I don't know. Now, today, obviously, and maybe this week or the next month or the next 6 months, you're going to get away with it. I don't know that they're going to be able to keep the inflation rate lying to people down, and I don't think the 10-year rate is going to not reflect the fact that people think the inflation rate's going up. I don't see them getting the 10-year rate back down to 1.5 or 1 or wherever it got. So I think they are a little bit more in danger this time. I mean, I think they got away with it once, and they should just say thank you very much, but they're not going to. And this is my view of this. Now, in the short term, I think you want to be, we're as long as we can get and still be protected. It doesn't mean that if it turns around, we don't have puts for people. We do. I'm trying to handle this as best I can for people, because I promise protection for the people who want. Now, we have people that don't need protection, which do that too. But for the people that do, I'm trying to orchestrate this as best I can. In the last couple of days, we seem like we're doing it right. Now, who knows if today we turn the other way, and, you know, God knows. But it seems somewhat almost predictable. The market's never predictable, but the policy is. Where am I wrong here?
I don't think you're wrong. With the fluctuations in the last, the downward pressure, for the last week or two, I'm beginning to think was in some ways a response to, the Trump phenomenon, that this was kind of a self-confirming prophecy that, Trump was going to upset the apple cart, in lots of ways, and the stock market was prepared to, sort of give us a signal that this is sort of what was expected and could be used as leverage against Trump politically or against policies that the market feels, are somehow getting too close to the bone. And I just, the way things have somewhat bounced back, I mean, we've had a couple of good days, not maybe as good as we'd like, but I get the feeling that it's not anything more than just kind of a political response to something that, the economic forces are upset about or uncomfortable with and feel like they're losing control over, and that this is a way of protesting. Or when you look at what some of the politicians have been doing with Tesla stock and, running the thing into the ground in comedy skits and everything else, knowing that this is hurting a lot of pension funds and state budgets and everything else, and not caring. I feel a lot of this is just kind of wanton destruction for the sake of getting some kind of, political bargaining point. And, that's pretty disgusting. But, I feel that that's kind of what we're dealing with at some level.
Well, in the Tesla part, Jan,
it's a very rational response, I guess, but it's got irrational results and this kind of a lack of interest in seeing this for the damage it's doing, too.
Well, there's nobody, I'll tell a quick story. I was involved in a at Pullman. I was the guy that walked into a meeting one day and said, we got to lay people off for a month. I don't think I ever had a crummier day that I ever had a message I ever deliver other than people, somebody in their family dying or something. I thought it was brutal, and yet it was so totally orchestrated. And when I say orchestrated, we had, Pullman had signed up for this contract for these commuter cars for Boston. And we had our schedule, and we were on schedule, and all of a sudden the chairman of Pullman, or whoever he was, gets a call from the governor of Massachusetts and says he's in a tough primary. It's a true story, but you're going to say, who the hell made this story up? He was in a tough primary. They hadn't had a railroad car literally in 50 years or 60 years. I mean, you know, you could see the rails going by through some of the cars or holes in the floor. And he said, I need a car out here for the primary. Is there any way you can get a car out here, like, you know, 2.5 months sooner? And everybody's going, maybe it was 2 months sooner. Well, somehow or another, we pulled it off. I mean, it wasn't, I'm not saying every single part was in there, but it's one thing to call your suppliers up and say, we need the trucks, we need the seats, you know, 3 weeks sooner or something, or where guys can actually do that. This was like a couple of months. So we ended up with essentially a handmade car. And we got it out there. Never really, even though I was doing the best I could, never really understood exactly what it was doing to us till finally we got all these guys working. But when it's the math is, hopefully I'm not going to cause everybody to turn away here. The math is somewhat, whenever the engineers put together drawings and they put together worksheets, for lack of a better term. And the first thing you do is you take part A and screw it to part B using screw C, right? And using screwdriver D. I mean, everything is all placed out. Manufacturing engineers do all that stuff. Well, if you have, and everything you do has a standard hour to it. So if it takes, literally, if it's three screws from part A to part B, the standard hours might be 15 minutes or 10 minutes. So if it takes somebody a half hour, you're working at 50% efficiency, right? Well, if you have a certain amount of operations, they call them, per day, and the average, like, half hour in operation, and you got how many people working on them, you can sort of back into your efficiency, correct? Am I losing everybody here already? Anyway, but so all of a sudden, we didn't have any material, and yet we'd already hired all these guys. And I said to the plant manager, I said, you know, if you're going to bring in 50 people on a Saturday, and we've only got parts to do 5 hours worth of work, even if everybody scrambles and is quick like a bunny, your efficiency is going to be 10%, right? I mean, if you just do the math. And I said, even if everybody's here ready to work, nobody's hung over, and everybody's working as hard as they can, there's nothing for them to do because we don't have the parts yet. Oh, man, it's really something. I said, you know, we got to lay people off for 2-3 weeks. Finally, he goes, okay, we'll call a meeting. You tell everybody that. They go, wait a minute. I'm 24 years old. Well, how am I the guy, you know? But he backed out, and I was the guy. So I go in, and I had known a lot of the people from the plant. I'd been over there, there was a reasonably respect for it. So I gave all my numbers, and everybody's sitting there. It's about 8 guys. And of course, they're bitching a blue streak at me. How could you guys screw up this bad, and blah, blah, blah. And so finally, they all leave, and I'm sitting there. You know, I didn't back down, but I also didn't feel so hot. And the program manager goes, hey, you did great. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, you got to learn to read people. Everybody in this room knew you were right. They were just venting, and you just happened to be here. Everybody respects you. They all know the numbers. You pointed out right to them. They understood exactly what you're talking about. You know, so somewhere, Elon Musk, and whether he's doing the right thing, wrong thing, he has not done that for people. People are blaming him individually because he's making light of the people that he's kicking out. They didn't do anything anywhere. They were lazy. You can't do that. I made sure I didn't say, hey, these guys sat around half a day Saturday. I never said that, even though I know they did because there was nothing for them to do. You know, so, I mean, there's a way. But back up a little bit, John, on this. Tesla has been a company that we've talked about on the show, and I'm ragging on too bad, for how many years they've been getting these big checks from other companies, these carbon checks, right? You could make a case, and I before I say this, I probably should go back. You could make a case that up until a couple of years ago, they never made any money if they didn't get those checks. Plus, everybody from the Obama and administration got all this money to buy the electric car. I mean, you could make this
and similar to Amazon.
Yeah. So you could certainly make the case that if it wasn't for government largesse and checks from people like you that went out and bought a Ford pickup and part of the money went to him, that there never would have been a company. So that has all started to ratchet down in the last few years to the point where I don't know if he's getting any checks now. He's probably getting something, some of the incentives to buy the electric. So all this is kind of happening in the background, even if he never did any of this Doge stuff. So, because all these other companies like Rivian and people like that, I think their machines look a hell of a lot nicer than his. They've always been in a hole, right? They've never made a dime ever, even though that's the nicest looking truck I've ever seen. Anyway, I'm saying all this kind of is happening as well. So you can't just assume that the beat up on Tesla is all because people not liking him. It's not helping. But if the company was still making money, believe me, it wouldn't make any difference whether they liked him or not. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I don't think. So, I mean, it's all kind of happening. It's sort of like a perfect storm for Tesla. I mean, now it's up $10 today.
It makes me think, too, Tom, that things like ESG, equity, social governance, and investments that are made in the name of, socially appropriate causes and, climate-oriented, desires that worked in Tesla's favor, up until fairly recently. And I think ESG is the kind of the part of the business equation here that is maybe likely to die last, with what Trump is trying to accomplish. Because now, I mean, all of the things that Tesla was being, praised for in the woke community, who demonized fossil fuels and wanted, internal combustion cars outlawed, and all of this has now spun back in the other direction that Musk is not on board apparently with that agenda. So it's just as easy to try to tank the stock as it was to push it. And of course with ESG it doesn't matter if you make
profit. John, if you strip away the advantages, I mean everybody else, a lot of people buy Tesla's got a lot of dough, so it's not going to, they don't pay any highway tax. And by the way, they're heavier than regular cars. So the beauty of the highway tax, if there is such a thing, is that if I drive a Suburban, which I did, which got crummy gas mileage, and I'm, it's also heavier than anything else, so I'm using twice as much gas as the next guy, I pay twice as much highway tax, which there's a certain logic to it. Well, what if you were to say, the average person drives, 20,000 miles a year? I'm just doing real stupid math here. 20,000 miles a year, so that's, if you get 20 miles per gallon, it's 1,000 gallons of gas, which means you're paying between state, local, and federal, you're probably paying, pick a number, 25 cents a gallon for highway use taxes, which the electric cars don't and haven't ever. So why? I don't think it's going to stop you, Mr. Moneybucks, you're going out and buying a Tesla if you wanted one. But basically, if you send everybody on an electric car a bill for $250 a year and say pay up, it's a little less of a reason why you might want this Tesla, right? And that's never happened. So if you even things, I'm saying a lot of this stuff is starting to even up a little on the guy at the same time all this other crap's happening. So it's to try and pick which is first and which is the most, the timing seems like it's more political than the other, but the other's been percolating in the background now for a while, hasn't it?
Well, yeah, it was always very short-sighted. You're absolutely right about the highway taxes and so on, but also none of this was really getting designated or earmarked for any kind of expansion of the electric grid. So if everybody all of a sudden was able to buy and wanted to buy an electric car, there'd be no way to buy it.
Oh, John, wait, you're going way too far. You mean you actually want to say that because if everybody uses an electric car, we need a beefed up electric grid and some of the money should go for that? You're way beyond.
I'm just saying that.
Did you just come in from planet Pluto? Where did you come from?
Nobody had any interest in even talking about that or deciding what this would mean if all of a sudden how much of your kilowatt hours were being devoted to keeping your car, running the next morning, or having charging stations adequate for long, trips and so on. No, that was never part of anybody's real thinking. It was all about virtue signaling. This is the right thing to do. And God help us if we have to bankrupt ourselves or put ourselves in darkness to do it, we'll do it. This is the craziness of the whole thing. But that feeling is still very much alive in the business world. I mean, you can see it with Disney and the entertainment industry. They don't have the message in any of this, and they don't seem likely to be changing any of their thinking or, you know, business plans over it either. So it's kind of, you know, to me, it's, you know, you can easily get on the wrong side of these people pretty fast by aligning yourself with somebody who's as polarizing as Trump is. And what worked in your favor before, despite maybe, you know, good sense or good economics, can just as easily come back and bite you now. And nobody's figured out how to control that kind of monster.
Well, no, the idea of electric cars is that nobody wants to give anybody the whole story. I would say that if you have a spot where you can pick up some, you know, place where you can put a little windmill or some, and you charge your electric car yourself out of stuff that's not even on the grid, and, you know, and it's, you can, I'll use the term buzz around town. They have more range than that. If all of a sudden you drop my ass out in Barrington and I still got my pickup and I got something else and Audrey has her nice car, and would I mind some little if I was retired, a little job in the market to drive the golf course like Bill every day in one and not pay anybody any gas? Yeah, why wouldn't I? I mean, and there's going to be a spot in the city where you have electrical power, and maybe you want some electric buses. Maybe let everybody roll their way. I mean, we're talking about a country, for those that might dig into my... John, if you're bored, slam the phone down or something. The best streetcar system, from what I understand, ever in this country was in L.A., which were all electric. They were tied into the wires. And all of a sudden, General Motors did a bunch of studies that said, these things are inefficient, blah, 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 and they tore them all up. There's pictures, and you go on YouTube and find them, of them all stacked up, and everything went buses. And anybody who thinks that buses in traffic are better than a segregated... Now, Chicago was different. Chicago's streetcar system was in traffic. It wasn't segregated, so it wasn't near as good. But L.A.'s, I believe, was segregated. And it was cheap, and you get one end of L.A. to the other pretty darn fast, which you can't today. So the industry's put that out of business through government. And all of a sudden, we're going back the other way. Oh, no, you can't have a bus anymore. You got to have something that's electric. Well, okay, but now where's the electric coming from? Which should be the next question. Now, if you have a gasoline-powered car... Like, you know, Carl will tell you this, and versus you having a windmill in your place or something where you're going short distances, you're way better off, I think, with the electric piece. But now, if the electric powered car, your electricity plant is 200 miles away and they're burning natural gas and then have to pump it over the wire with that degradation, you're way more efficient burning the gas in the car, right? I mean, you're going to get 90 or 95% efficiency out of a furnace at home, or 85% or whatever it is, gas furnace. The last thing you want to do is burn gas 200 miles away, pump the electricity in your house and heat your house by electric. So it's where you're getting it from. But nobody, does anybody ever ask any of these questions? Why? I mean, that's why nuclear is so, I'll tell you something simple, Jen. Why don't people who have electric charging stations get a bunch of batteries and drag down that power at night? When the nukes are still on, you can get that power at night for next to nothing. Charge up your batteries and then charge your stuff during the day. I mean, does anybody even think of that? Why not?
The consumer has to think of that. You know, you're going to run your appliances after 9 o'clock or something because it's cheaper.
But you don't get any cheaper, do you?
Care about that. So.
But you don't get anything cheaper on your home bill, do you?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you do. Mine doesn't have anything about time of day.
Yeah, I think, you know, the off hours. I mean, this maybe is always the case of power. You know,
well, I don't use much power, so my big chunk of the bill is just the wire into the house, which frosts me constantly. But I,
you know, really all this time, you know, it shows that the Newton's law really doesn't work in this kind of discussion, because you would think, you know, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. Well, you look at the pushing of the interstate highway system in the 50s, which, you know, whatever it did to encourage people to purchase cars, and they were cheap then, and gas was really cheap. But it killed the rail industry, certainly the passenger rail industry. The United States had a pretty good one given its size, but the result of that is that we have hardly anything, and it has to be federally subsidized pretty much to make it work at all anymore. So that we sacrifice that to get what exactly? You know, something where the roads are continuously torn up, and you know the maintenance is expensive. As like we were saying with Bill earlier, you know, none of this contributes to prosperity at all. But we've given up so much to get some kind of objective that somebody sold, you know, politicians, and everybody got in step with it. Electric vehicles are kind of an example of that. We don't have enough people to service them. You can't find a lot of service stations that will touch an electric car or a hybrid car now. They don't want to do it. So, you know, or if you have to replace a battery, or you got to find a charging station or whatever else. Nobody had computed the cost of that first. So none of this now makes, you know, as much sense as it was supposed to. And then you got, you know, boards of corporations and stuff twiddling their thumbs trying to see how they can get political leverage out of this in whatever direction. The whole thing is nuts.
Well, the whole railroad thing, I mean, we don't have the time today, but there's reasons why the passenger rail, in a lot of ways, never made a lot of money for railroads anyway. Because as the freight built up, anyway, this is just kind of a long story, our system was never really designed for modern passenger stuff, where Europe's was. In Europe, you never run a freight train over the same tracks that your passenger train runs on. So I mean, when you see stuff from place to place here, say from Chicago to Milwaukee, you'll see, that might be different because maybe they took the freight off that road. But you see, virtually all your railroad lines are two tracks, right? Well, they used to be one, right, way back in the day. So there's two tracks. Now, what's the problem with that? You say, well, gee, you got one is for the trains going one way and one for the trains going the other, right? I mean, duh.
Well, and you have freight competing with.
Well, the problem is if you run, so let's say the Union Pacific line west, if you've ever driven out through Nebraska and so forth, you've got two tracks, and you have, I think, actually ran into a guy a long time ago. Your rail on the main line, your freight trains run essentially 55 miles an hour, and they're maybe 15 to 20 minutes apart. If you're really busy, maybe 25, or obviously if you're not as busy or as apart as you're going to get. But they're running 55 miles an hour. You can't run 56 because you catch the guy in front of you, or you can't run 54, the guy behind you catches you. So this is all orchestrated. Now, where exactly do you put a 90-mile-an-hour freight passenger line on that line? You don't, right? I mean, they don't want any part of passenger. The reason why Amtrak is you know, not as... doesn't do as well is they're into long term. You don't make any money on the Empire Builder. You can make money running back and forth from Detroit to Chicago if you can go 90 miles an hour. Now, okay, how are you going to go 90 miles an hour? You're not going to do it where there's freight. So in Europe, there's always been three rails, right? Two for freight, one for passenger. They never ran the same tracks. Plus, you never had any crossing. You never had roads crossing railroad tracks like we do with the gates coming down. You either went over the road or you went under it. So you never had traffic freight interface where they could possibly run into each other unless the car ran off around the bridge. These are big props. You're not going to run an Amtrak train through Michigan City in the middle of the night at 100 miles an hour, are you? You'd shake the whole damn...
But you know, we also gave up things like interurban railroads, you know, short runs. And
except for one. We got one left.
One left, but, you know, and it's you know, tenuous, I guess. I
mean, no, they just rebuilt the whole thing. It's beautiful now.
Yeah, it took him, what, 8 years?
Oh, yeah, 8 years. Yeah, a long time.
But all you know, if there wouldn't be a trucking industry or the need for trucks or anything else, had they not, you know, catered to that industry and invited people to invest in it by building the interstate highway system. All of this was based on things that had to be done first. Had that same money and energy been put into something other than just one or two line tracks, we'd be speaking about something very differently. You know, cars were never very affordable in Europe. It made sense for them to, you know, not...
Well, cars were affordable, you just couldn't buy the gas.
Yeah, and in this country, that you know, they were comparatively cheap, and everybody owned a car. And the idea was let's make everybody buy another car or two cars and drive it all over Helongwan, and we'll make it so you can do it. But that's got consequences down the road. That, you know, it hasn't made a commuting, you know, experience any better. I would say for people in big cities, it's killed it. It's turned it into a complete waste of resources and fuel and, you know, budgets and everything else. So we didn't ponder all that. Nobody has, I guess, enough time or energy to think that far ahead.
Well, we're not thinking far ahead on anything. We have a break here, John. We should have already been hanging around.
She's here. I see.
We're going to do a quick break. But, you know, it's the Trump tariffs, other than, well, I'm going to be an ass here, other than if anybody's close to the man making a fortune on front-running the markets, what have we accomplished? No one, given the in-and-out story of the tariffs, is going to buy. You're not going to find anybody, if you and I were in that business, Audrey might, where somebody's going to say, hey, Audrey, take me out today and find me a manufacturing building on the south side. All this stuff's coming back, and I'm starting from scratch, and I got, you know, $2 billion to punk in this building. Nobody is making that call based on the fact that these things are on again, off again. I mean, how could you? You know, I don't see.
It isn't like you can run an economy on long term tariffs.
No, I'm saying
it's all about leverage, and this is what business people do all the time. This is how they keep the ball in their court, or add something to the mix, throw somebody off of their rhythm by demanding something, and somebody has to think on the fly to get something in the air just as fast and try to counteract it. So it's gamesmanship, and I understand the reasons for it. It isn't about how you're necessarily going to balance a budget this way, but you could certainly get stuff that you want out of it. And I think this is what the long term.
Well, now there's a big headline this morning about Hyundai coming here, made a $20 billion investment. Well, they're going to get so much stuff from her. How the hell are you and I going to compete against that? What are we going to? We're going to borrow on our credit card. Where they're getting dough from the government. I think that's an uneven game. S&P futures up 69. NASDAQ futures up 307. We're giddy this morning because the market's this far. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you! Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jock. Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I am also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that.
Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
It's like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
Whoa, whoa, okay, Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Matt Byrne on the board. SP Futures up 67. Yeah, 67. NASDAQ Futures up 303. Don't want no stinking down markets like we've had the last few weeks. We've gone up, up, and we're going up today, which is a good thing. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 15. Not much there. Call that flat. FTSE's down 8. CAC around's down 8. That's wild. Not so sure why they, those guys are not celebrating with us. Nikkei down 68.2%. Hang Seng up 215. That's 0.9. They were down heavy one of the last couple days of last week. Shanghai up 5. They haven't been doing much, but they've been creeping. Shanghai is a... Now they're saying they're going to make the place more conducive to investment and everything else over in China. We'll see what they actually do. Friday we were up, just as a way of review. Dow was up 32. S&P up 4. NASDAQ up 92. Not much, but we're up a little bit. Bonds, 10-year up 5 basis points, 4.30. That's a pretty good size move. Bund up 2 basis points, 2.78. Japan up 2, 1.55, which has to be a high for those guys for like a long time. Oil up 44 cents, 68.72, so moving up a little bit, but still appreciably under 70. Brent up 38 cents, 72.54. Natural gas down 4, 393, under 4 bucks. Gold up 11.80, 3,033, still maintaining over 3,000. Silver up 25 cents, 33.74. Foreign exchange, we're at 108.25, not as high as we were, or the euro was. The euro did make it up to 109. Now it's backed off a little bit. Pound, though, is paying steady. The 129 number, 129.4. We've got Bitcoin up 2,400. That's a big, pretty big move, 2.8%, 87,423. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Yeah, good morning. It's currently 7:37 a.m. on March 24th, 2025. As far as weather in Chicago, it's 36 at Midway, 35 at O'Hare. High temperature of around 48 degrees today. Expect a sunny, breezy day. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, 66 degrees this morning at Sky Harbor Airport, high of 94. Expect sunny skies today. In the NCAA basketball, that was yesterday, March Madness continued. In men's, we saw Michigan State won against New Mexico, 71-63. Illinois lost 75-84 against Kentucky. And Iowa State lost as well, 78-91 against Ole Miss. Games will continue on Thursday, March 27th. Over to women's, Michigan loses to Notre Dame, 55-76. Kansas State won against Kentucky in a close game, 80-79. UCLA beat out Richmond, 84-67. And then today, Michigan State faces off with NC State today at 11 a.m., Illinois against Texas at 1, and Iowa versus Oklahoma at 3 p.m. So you got your whole afternoon planned out there. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
Some of the ladies' games are pretty good.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Do we have Audrey?
We do indeed, yeah.
Hey, Audrey, how are you?
Good morning. Just fine. How are you, gentlemen, this morning?
Gentlemen.
Good, thank you.
Who you calling a gentleman?
That's generous.
Yes.
And you.
No, we're doing fine. We had a real nice conversation with John and with Bill. Bill is so clear on how these projects are working. It's fair to say, John, that he doesn't understand how the hell they're working here. Is that a fair statement?
Well, nobody here does.
Yeah. Well, Bill was more... He did highway stuff, but he kind of veered into his big thing were big, huge water treatment plants. And he did one, and that's why he moved around so much. I remember when I was at Allied Van Lines, I visited him out in California. They were putting one in. He did one in Florida. I'm sure he gave us a list of all the ones he put in. And they're incredible undertakings, a huge water treatment plant. And I'm sure one of these days he'll tell us that the hardest part, the most dangerous part, is getting the oxygen back into water. Because you can't just, if you just clean it all out, just dead water. It's like distilled water. Nobody can live in that. You got to get oxygen back in it, and that's the hard part. So it's real. One day we'll ask him to explain all that in 30 words or less. But it's kind of fun. So Ed, what's going on in your biz? I know you've been pretty busy as usual. Still kind of the same sort of people, although you have all kinds of different kinds. I'm surprised you did a few rentals in the city, and Well, you were busy with that stuff. The city rentals are still busy, huh?
Yeah. So first of all, I'm going to tell you right now, my computer says the internet connection is unstable, so we'll have to see.
I blame your dog, but they're chewing on a wire or something.
I blame your dog. But at as far as downtown goes, I just did a deal for a longtime client. He was actually buying a condo on the north side, River North area there, and a parking spot. And you know, the city of Chicago, it's always, you know, some drama, some extra form, and have some rentals going on the northwest side of the city, a popular area close to the Blue Line. So, yeah, it's springtime in Chicago, so it's about the time now the leases are all ending, and it's the time people are shuffling around. So March, April, May, and then your fall expiration is when most of the landlords' leases are tied to, so that's when you'll see most of them moving. So that's just getting going right now.
Well, you had all kinds of people wanting one of the places that had access to O'Hare.
Oh, that was, yeah, that's a great spot. A lot of people who work at O'Hare Airport, the pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, they all like that area because literally it's a 2-minute walk to hop on the Blue Line. You go right into the terminal. It makes life a little easier, especially when you've got a strange schedule and you're coming and going. So, yeah, that's nice, and it helps that he has a beautiful building. So, yes, that's all. It's all good, but you know, rentals are expensive, so it's just a tough market for everybody right now. Because even according to the latest reports that have come out, the Midwest is still very short in inventory, and then you'll go into Florida and parts of Texas where there's a lot because there was a lot of building, but Midwest is still showing low inventory. So even with regular housing in the areas, it's competition for the homes. Yet there's still not enough inventory. Though interest rates coming down may pry some people out of their homes if they really do want to move. So now we're seeing things in the mid sixes right now.
This is a really stupid question and probably not important to anybody. But do pilots and flight attendants, do they have parking that, or are they paying the same rate as everybody else? I mean, it used to be United had like a huge lot for everybody, and they would bus everybody back and forth. Do they still do that, or you have to park like the rest of us schmoes?
I think you'd have to ask a pilot. That's out of my jurisdiction. I just rent the place.
You guys, the people on the show seem to know all kinds of
stuff.
I'm
sure there's some place for people O'Hare to park, otherwise it would make it a little difficult for them.
Yeah, it's a, you know, the oddest thing I ever saw. You guys ever go to the, who knows what it's like now, but if you went to the casinos in Atlantic City and you're taking the parkway up there, it was kind of, I think it was a toll road, there was a spot in the parkway where for like a 2-mile spot, all the people working the casinos parked between the two sides of the 4-lane highway, and then they got bussed in from there. Didn't have to pay.
You know what? We kind of got the same thing here, though not on the parkway. You know, there's little places where you go park in shopping plaza areas where you go park and the casino bus picks you up, drives you there, brings you back to your car in the parking lot.
That's true.
You know, that's scattered around Chicago.
You see guys like John, you know, retired guys like John heading to the casino 4 days a week with all the blue-haired ladies, you know. So what's anything new going on in the business? I mean, Nancy was saying that some of the refi business picked up a little bit. She's doing some more mortgages. I know you're pretty busy. You've been pretty steady, but I don't know if you're busier or not because I never saw you slow down this winter. I mean, maybe the weather helped or whatever, but you've been pretty steady the whole way.
Yeah, I have been busy. I'm very lucky. I've got wonderful clients, which I greatly appreciate. But it was a little quieter November, December, as soon as they raised the interest rates again, and they went up to, you know, 7.5, 7.75, everybody pulled back. But in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a drop in interest rates, and this whole spring market was getting going, but to come back into the mid-sixes now you've got people coming out and looking. So
what is a day like today?
You're really ashamed about at least.
Well, the 10-year...
I don't know. I haven't looked at the rates today.
It's been slipping.
I would say right now you're running about What?
Oh, my question is, the 10-year has been slipping down. It got down into the 4.2s from the 4.5 or 6, and that is right to what you're talking about. Well, now today, for whatever reason, it's up almost a half a point to 1.1. How quickly does that make it into, like, next week? If it stays here, is Nancy going to tell me, oh, yeah, we were 6.5 and now we're 6.5?
The rates change constantly. Nancy screens when she watches them, she's shopping for rates. They change like your options board.
Really?
They will reflect, yeah, different types of investors, different banks, different situations. Yeah, that's why she says, if you want to lock this in, what rate do you want to lock in? You have to literally sometimes hit the button to lock that rate in for the client.
So literally, if I was talking to her about a mortgage...
It doesn't just sit there. It's an active market.
Okay, so if I was talking to her on Friday about a rate, she might have been saying 6.55, and then she looks at this thing today and goes, hey, you snooze, you lose, now it's 6.7 because it's up that much. It could actually, or 6.6.
Maybe.
All right, well, then...
Things will jump, yeah.
It's interesting. Well, you were, I mean, some of the stuff, the closing and stuff you were involved, did you ever people get totally screwed on a rate they didn't lock in?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the rate would change, you know, at, you know, the deal would go south. I mean, this was, you know, a fairly common thing when things were volatile. They're always volatile to some extent. But I don't, do you see deals, you know, not working in, you know, these days, Audrey, because of appraisals or, you know, job losses or anything? Does that seem to, you know, be looming in the wings of, as things that can sabotage a deal?
So far, I haven't had a problem with each, but I noticed nationwide. But this is now probably from 4 or 5 months ago, I've noticed the floor closure rate ticking up. So that was back then. I haven't seen it rising now, but I haven't tracked it that much in the last month or so. But it ticked up in the fall, like in the mid fall or so. You see a lot of it then.
Once in a while, Aud and Jan, I'll get a missive from a listener or somebody or a contributor to the show, and they'll say, automobile late payments have gone up, you know, 3 or 4% in the last month, or there's more mortgages in arrears than any time. And was the one last week we talked about, Jan? Was it mortgages are being in arrears countrywide?
And car repossessions,
yeah,
too.
That somehow or another, I don't know, it's not like you or us. I mean, Chicago obviously has not got some problems that are separate, but it seems like some of the stuff that hits the national numbers haven't really hit your area. When I say your area, well, I live in Orland, but she does business, you know, within 30 miles around Orland, which is a lot of people. But it doesn't seem like you're affected as much by these numbers as, you know, some place where a plant gets up and leaves or something like that. I mean, it seems a little less volatile here, is it?
You know, so far it's been fine. But again, to your point, a small town with a factory, you know, and inflation has killed a lot of people. I mean, it's devastating to people that were just making it when times were pretty good. And now all of a sudden they've got kids to feed and groceries have doubled and tripled. Gas had doubled. So, you know, the last couple of years for people have been last three years? The inflation, especially the last couple of years, was horrible. And that's what triggered a lot of it is people, they couldn't make enough money to keep up. If you basically had to add another at least third to your salary to keep up, and that was becoming not enough. So this has been percolating. People went through their savings, couldn't make enough money where they're working, and now I think that's what was filtering in the economy. The average person, you know, if you're a fairly wealthy person, you're going to go buy your dozen eggs. But if, you know, your budget for eggs was a buck and a half to 2 and a quarter, and they're $7 or $8. Something's got to give when you're feeding a family of 4 or 5.
Well, you, I mean, not to get, well, I was asking you kinds of questions. I mean, Aud is a perfect person to ask these to because she got a nice home that, you know, has the same stuff that happens every home. I mean, she maintains it real well. What hurts more? Plus, you know, she's always out and about because she's driving people over the damn place. So the gas and all that stuff. I mean, if anybody has her finger on the pulse of the prices and stuff, it's Audrey. And what hurts more, the, you know, the eggs? I mean, you know, you don't have eight kids. Eggs going up a couple of bucks, or the fact that, let's say, for instance, you needed a new air conditioner or something, and, you know, it's been 20 years or whatever, and all of a sudden you go, okay, well, I got $3,000 for that, and the guy goes, yeah, well, it's not three, it's eight. I mean, I think some of these shocking service types of things, or if your poor dog gets sick or something, and you think it's $300 and it's like $2,500, I think those shocks are hurting people more than the, you know, because you get, you know what? You know, I cook in the office. If I don't want to have eggs, I can make flapjacks. I mean, there's substitutions to that. There's no substitution to your heater or your air conditioner or your dog sick or your roof. I mean, what do you think's hurting more? I mean, I don't want to lead the witness here. I think it's the B stuff, the stuff you never dreamed that your transmission in your car is $2,500 and not $500 like it used to be. What do you think's hurting people the most?
Well, everything is expensive. But what the bigger thing is, if you look at the big picture, the increase in building supplies and furnaces and that all started during COVID.
Yeah.
And that has not gone back. Then COVID, then we had that, then that was one excuse. Then the ports being closed was another excuse, and shipping was an excuse. So all of the things that you need to live, which of course, again, drove up the price of new homes, drives up the price of cars. So I think that actually came first, and that was just a result of COVID. That wasn't, you know, the chicken and egg thing. So that was percolating since back in 2020.
Yeah, I'm more in the, and you guys can, you know, can throw something at me even through the phone. I'm more in the part that people somehow, to a certain extent, can adjust. I mean, if the price of if beef goes up, you know, you're gonna eat more pork and chicken. It's not like the consumer price index. I don't know what you can do if you get a scratch on your car and you go in and expect the guy to say it's $100 and he says it's $1,500. I think there's parts of the inflation stuff that people thankfully aren't aware of yet. You don't know that the roof has tripled in price until you need one, right?
Well, I think most people, especially homeowners who do a lot of, you know, who do their own repairs, or people who are in the trades, they've been aware of this, the price of nails.
Yeah.
I mean, anything that you want to work around your house with is enormous. I mean, I was looking at replacing my deck. So let's say 5 years ago, maybe the deck was $15,000. It's now $32,000 to do the deck I want.
You can pay $100,000 for a deck now.
Yeah, that's not, yeah. Oh, yeah. A pool, swimming pools are big now since COVID. People want their old pools. And a pool, which used to be able to put in the ground, average pool was maybe 30 or 40. They're like 80 and 100 and up now.
No, wait, you just disappointed Jen. What happened to the one you guys are putting in this summer, Jen?
The price of things, the price of things since COVID has gone up dramatically. And everything else, like there's like, oh, shipping is delayed. It takes gas to run tankers. So it's just been compounding since like 2020. And here we are.
Yeah, I would say that the deck that I put on the garage that 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I used the same wood that I used on the little deck up on the top last year. And I'm saying the little deck cost more than the garage deck. And it was only like 4 years ago. I don't think it was even close. I mean, it was like $15.
Prices are coming down low. I've seen some cheap gas out here. Eggs have been come down remarkably. So that's great. I mean, I'm seeing some decent prices on things. So I see some relief here. So I think everybody's a little happy about that. So we'll just have to see how it goes.
Well, John, I'll let you ask a few questions. But in terms of insurance, the places in just a blank. I'll let Jack take over. Places like we were talking about it at dinner yesterday. Pacific Palisades and some of the stuff in Florida and things like that. Do you think the insurance checks are going to come close to the rebuild numbers for any of these people?
I think they'll have to. What do you think, John?
I think they'll, you know, if you had replacement value in your policy, Yeah, and that's kind of a meaningless term now because, I have a similar thing, on the two flat that I own here, but replacement value doesn't mean that I'll get oak floors like are in here now. It doesn't, or the paneling that I have in my back room, or plaster walls, or all the things that kind of made this place charming and livable to me.
No, you're right.
And I will get something that will be, it'll be a compromise in every way, in both the quality of the materials and probably the quality of the workmanship too. By the time you're through, and so replacement value is a term of art, but it doesn't really describe what you're getting with that insurance check. You're getting something that you're going to have to, put up with, not something that you're happy to be in. So
Well, my insurance aid, we were having this discussion because I got a notice saying, do you want to change this to full replacement value, to your point? And he said, even in the meantime, if I change my flooring out, and I was thinking about switching the tile out of the kitchen to hardwood of some type, you have to let the insurance company know that you have hardwood, and then they insure that's they add that cost of replacement to your insurance policy.
Right.
So but if you don't, then you have to fire, they won't.
Yeah, good luck on those hardwood doors and brass knobs, John. You're getting it, buddy.
Yeah. So you'll pay.
So if you let them know, they'll insure it, but there goes your premium.
Right, exactly.
Do either one of you know the what happens if the evil specter of different building codes come flying in? Because I got to believe you're not building any of those places in Palisades or Florida the way they were built before. Do they cover that, do you think?
No. I mean, they're not going to guarantee that you'll get approval for plans or what kind of plans will be given approval. And God knows what's going to happen to the zoning and planning, in these places when it comes time to start issuing permits. They're going to be very careful because they're looking at infrastructure issues that they didn't bargain for that have to be fixed to make these neighborhoods livable again. And I just think that you're going to get really stringent controls on the type of things you can build, the size and the quality. And it's kind of what's happening in Florida now because of their, natural disasters or the propensity towards them, that, it costs a lot to keep a condo, reserved enough in its funds to take care of something that is going to otherwise wipe out the whole building if the owners can't pay for it when it needs to be done.
Well, Jan and Aud talked to the lady. I mean, in the family, so Aud gets to talk to her. The cousin who has the place in Florida with the condo building, it's been 2 years now, Aud. She's still paying her mortgage and still can't get into the building to get her stuff, other than they got in there once or something. The place is somewhat condemned. They still have not been able to get the engineering people there to determine whether they got to tear it down or they can fix it. What's the life on that? Could that be 10 years from now? She's still paying the mortgage and still can't live there? I mean, is there something that has to happen here where somebody says we're either tearing it down or the bank takes it? Or what's the end game for this? Do either one of you know?
I don't know that. I think that it's... And yeah, that's a problem what they're going to do. But I was just thinking about what John said. And in Indiana, do you guys remember, like in Beverly Shores, a lot of people that had homes along Lake Michigan there, they started falling into the water because these homes dated back to the 30s and 40s. And what happened, if I remember correctly, Tom may remember, is that the city or the state reclaimed that condemned property. They took it over. So what they did was turned it into like a leasehold for the land. So the homes that have not yet fallen to the water are on property that is just leased from the state. and when they're gone, nobody can build there. So there's not a bunch left. The ones that have just fallen in, they were not allowed to rebuild in that area.
I think that might have been part of the National Lakeshore from day one. Yes. That was all big lease.
Well, but I think, you know, that you're right, Audrey. And when you've got erosion, you've got a complete loss of your real estate. It's going to be underwater. It may not be the same thing in places like Pacific Palisades, but I think there are going to be places that are deemed unbuildable just because of the difficulty of getting in fire equipment and roads and maintenance and everything else. So I think you're going to see a much more conservative approach to where people can do what they formerly could do and were happy to pay to have done. I don't think you're going to have that same kind of ability in a lot of these places, just given the track record of what's happened.
I would say especially Florida. You know, yeah. The fire was one thing, but you know, where you don't know where your next hurricane's coming from, it's like Louisiana building in the lowlands with the flooding. At what point do you say, you know, what's the point? Because what are the odds? So I think that's going to be a difficult decision, because you're basically telling people they can't have their land back. That's right. A pretty tough thing to do.
Well, a simple case that Carl was talking about, if you've got we're back to Florida, we're skipping around. Suppose you had a slab house on a slab, a house on a slab, two blocks from the ocean, and of the storm surge, you know, your house is now gone, you got the slab. Well, the new zoning codes Carl was talking about might require you to have the house to have a concrete foundation up 5 feet from the slab.
That's not unusual with a flow-through foundation or stilts. That's not an unusual requirement for coastal properties.
Well, but
it actually makes sense.
Right, but it ends up to where you've got your check from the insurance company is, say, $200,000, and the architect, you know, Odds finds an architect, and the architect says, hey, I can put this thing back up. By the way, it's $450,000. What do you do? That person's liable to just say, hey, I'm out of here, and sells the land for whatever they can and walks. How much of that you think? Plus, what if you got to wait 2 years? You got to have some place to live. You're going to say, just what can I get for this land? I'm out of here. If the people in Palisades, if it's the 5-year plan to get those places back up, what are you going to do in the meantime? You'll be looking here, Audrey's going to be finding a rental place.
People will rent, because most people aren't going to give up oceanfront property willingly. They're not. Maybe they'll let it sit. Maybe they'll go rent somewhere else and regroup. But I don't know too many people who are going to give up a view of either the Gulf of Mexico or the Pacific Ocean willingly.
Well, I don't either. I'm just saying the magnitude of
especially since you usually have money to be living there in the first place.
Right, but the magnitude of 10,000 homes with new building codes, new inspecting. What's the time frame? I mean, even if everybody hopped to it, it's got to be what?
Yeah, but just think of all the migration of contractors. That's probably in effect. He's going to say, wow, I'm going to take my tools of the trade, go down south and make a bunch of money for the next few years in really nice weather.
I still wouldn't do it. Too many mosquitoes, too many alligators, and too humid. Just saying.
Chicken.
Yeah. Now, Palisades.
I'm just too old, Tom.
you'd be the supervisor.
Yeah. I'll do it on Zoom, yeah.
The first thing we'd have to put in was sidewalks, so the three of us could stand on a sidewalk and tell everybody else what to do.
Yeah, that'd be perfect for you.
Can you have a sidewalk superintendent? We're not a sidewalk.
Sure.
God. Well, thank you very much. Good stuff. John, as usual, good stuff. It was a fun show this morning. SP Futures up 69, plus the market's up. SP Futures up 321. What could be better, guys? Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks. Sure.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. JetBlue Airways. It's not the only way to fly, but it should be. Visit jetblue.com. Empower HR, your human resources partner. That's empowerhr.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. BDL Compliance Consulting. Visit bdlcc.com. DAX Research. Listen to David Andelman on Mondays and Thursdays and go to dacsresearch.net.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Fellow